I hope you got my message asking you to bring copies of the text. I'm going to be talking quite closely about chapter 11, the Canto of Ulysses, so I'll be ranging more widely than that. But I think you're going to need to follow that and also to be able to look up one or two other references. This 11th chapter begins in what could give or take the practical, technical details be one of Dante's circles of hell in the Inferno, the Hell, which is the first book of Dante's Divine Comedy. Primo Levi and five other men have the job of scraping out a rusty underground petrol tank. Rust powder gets into their mouths and under their eyelids. The place is cold and damp. And yet in the sort of perverse logic of the camp, this is a luxury job. Levi says this is a luxury job because no one supervised us. They're visited by Jean, a young student. There are some handouts at the front here for latecomers. They're visited by Jean, a young student from Alsace, who, because of its borderline character geographically between France and Germany, is bilingual in French and German. And he has risen, you remember, quickly to Jean has risen quickly to, because of his bilingualism and also because he's a good diplomat, to an administrative job in their hut. He's called a piccolo, and you know what that is if you've read the book. And he manages to maintain this diplomatic balance between the occupants and the brutal capo, the person in charge, who's called Alex. Now, Jean, in turn, has given Primo what is a privileged job, again, in the topsy-turvy world of the camp. It's a privileged job to carry the daily ration of soup and to the hut. And he asks him to leave the job he's doing because they've got to go and get the soup. And Jean has arranged things so that this can involve an hour's walk in the sun and the opportunity to talk a bit. He wants Primo Levi to teach him Italian. Now, Primo says he doesn't know why he begins with a passage from Dante's Inferno, but he does, and it's this Canto of Ulysses, which is Canto 26 in the Hell book of the Divine Comedy. Jean knows nothing whatever about Dante, so Primo Levi has quite a lot to explain. He outlines the Divine Comedy to him, explaining that it is the medieval Italian poet's spiritual testimony he narrates in it a journey through hell and then purgatory, a journey which is, there are some handouts here for latecomers, a journey which is guided by Virgil, the Latin poet whom you all know about. Now, there's already an interesting question here for the theologically minded. What is the position of pre-Christians in relation to hell and purgatory and paradise? And the severe Christian doctrine was tough. You know, you were born before redemption, and so you don't get redeemed. we'll see this in a moment. Virgil, however, is enabled to give Primo Levi a guided tour, and in the third book, Paradiso, Dante is guided instead by Beatrice, who's in real life a woman he's been crazy about, but in a kind of remote way, and as far as we know, that was all it came to. They were very susceptible, these Middle Ages guys. Now, in the first of these three sections, so I should say that the whole of the Divine Comedy is, among other things, a sort of encyclopedia of everything that was thought and known at the time of any importance, massive work. In the first of the three sections, that's Inferno, Dante imagines himself being taken on this guided tour on which they encounter both people Dante knew or that other people in his world will have known of, You know, it's as if, you know, he bumps into Berlusconi, as it were, or Mussolini, but middle-aged versions. He also bumps into sort of people, rather unexpected people who are related to him, and to people from the distant past. Some of them Virgil has to explain who they were, and some of them he already knows. He also learns about the very complex organization of hell, in which not only are there many, many, many subtle gradations of wickedness that are being punished, but subtle gradations of punishment which fit the crime. There's a handout here. And all this, I think, is very much in the background, and sometimes in the foreground, of Primo Levi's version of a real hell, Auschwitz. Now, in Canto 26, which in Dante is the Canto of Ulysses, Dante and Virgil come to a valley which is lit up by pillared, by tall flames. And each of these flames contains a single spirit, the remains of a single person. But some of these people are actually mythological. And one of them flickers, according to the narrative on page 118 in Levi's text, like a speaking tongue vibrant to frame language, come fosse la lingua che parlasse. This flame contains Ulysses, who is also Odysseus, but whose story takes many different forms as it is told throughout the world, so that the Ulysses of Dante is in various respects different from the Odysseus of the Odyssey. Now, Primo Levi, you remember, wants to teach Jean Italian, but something else takes over. He really feels that there's something about Dante. As soon as he starts to think about Dante, he feels there's something really terribly important that he has to impart to Jean that is relevant to their circumstances. First of all, he himself has to frame language, because Jean has French and German, but not Italian by definition, because he wants to be taught Italian. So Primo Levi has to translate the Italian into French. Secondly, he can't remember it very well. And we're brought face to face with one of the crucial things for anybody who loves literature in Auschwitz, that you don't have any books, so all you've got is what you can remember. And if you forget it, something has gone from you in a terribly important way. And fragments of the poem comes into his head, and he's not sure how they fit together. He can remember the outline of the story. He bashes on, trying to paraphrase what happens. They're getting near their destination. They're going to have to pick up this soup. They're going to have to pick up their soup. And Primo feels he's really got to remember Dante's own words. Now, I'll come back to what it is he wants to communicate, but let's consider what's going on here as a kind of version of aspects of the whole book. And then, first of all, there's the human situation. There are these two men who are in what might be considered a true hell rather than the mythological one that Dante wrote about. Secondly, and crucially, neither of them knows whether he will survive. We know that Levi is going to survive because we're reading his text, but at the time neither of them knew that. And Levi tells us explicitly that for all Jean's success in the camp, he, like everyone else, continued his secret individual struggle against death. That is page 116, almost as soon as he's been introduced. So Jean is this sort of lively, vivacious, hopeful, successful figure in the camp. But, like everybody else, he may die any minute. He may be sent to the gas chambers. He may contract a disease. He may weaken. Now, the reader by now has become accustomed to one of the various organizing principles of If This Is a Man. That is that very often, a chapter will include a focus, or indeed be a focus, on another individual whom Levi has encountered. And more often than not, that person hasn't been seen before and will never be seen again in the book. It's terribly important that these people come to life before our eyes and then they're gone. And that is one of the principles here. But if you think back in the book, there's Nolach Zane, there's Reshnik, there's Alfred L., there's Elias Linsin. And those last two that I've mentioned belong in a chapter just a bit before this one called The Drowned and the Saved, in which Levy categorizes people according to a kind of instinct that people developed in the camp about whether someone was going to make it or not, other things being equal. There are some people whose death is, he implies, almost self-willed once they've got to this terrible place. Drowning is a very potent metaphor in the book, and as we'll see, is very important in the Canto of Ulysses. Anyway, for now the men, Jean and Primo Levi, form a bond, but like all relationships in the camp, it's impeded by very many difficulties, particularly of language. I'll come back to language, as I said, but what Levy most wants to impart to Jean is, in fact, one of the most powerful and often quoted and translated and adapted and imitated passages in the whole of the Divine Comedy, this episode concerning Ulysses. And you remember, or you'll see, that there is, on page 119, for example, this intense urgency on Primo Levi's part. He wants Jean to understand this passage. He says, for my sake, my Primo Levi's sake. Now, in the poem, in Dante's poem, the situation is this. Ulysses wants to explore westwards. From the Mediterranean, he wants to go out of the Mediterranean, the known world at that time, the Middle Ages, through the Straits of Gibraltar into what we know as the Atlantic. And he wants to see what's out there. We know what's out there. And we know that 175 years after Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, another Italian, Cristoforo Colombo, would discover what was out there, America. Christopher Columbus, we call him. Cristobal Colón, the Spanish call him, and they claim that he was Spanish because they sponsored his trip, but actually he came from Genova. So we read that back into the story. But nobody in Dante's time knew what was out there. They knew it was very, very dangerous to go out into the Atlantic and that there were people who'd tried and who hadn't come back. This is what Ulysses imagined as, of course, the ancient Ulysses wants to do, and his crew are mutinous. They don't want to go there. They don't see the point of going there. And so Ulysses makes an impassioned speech, a morale-boosting speech, like sort of captain of a team, getting them into a huddle and saying, we can win. And if you look at your handout there, I've given you a parallel text version of the last part of this canto. It's not the same translation as the one you have in Primo Levi's text. Remember, it's a translation. You've got the Italian on one side, you've got a literal English translation on the other side. And in this version, page 119, what Ulysses says is just three lines. Think of your breed, he says, meaning your species. For brutish ignorance, your metal was not made. You were made men to follow after knowledge and excellence. And the literal translation, as you see it there, is closer to what the Italian says. It's consider your origin. You were not made to live like brutes, but to follow virtue, which in medieval Italian and Renaissance Italian means something more than being morally good. It means being heroic, means being stylish as well. It means being a lot of the things that can distinguish a human being at his or her best, to follow virtue and knowledge. Now, why is this passage so important to Primo Levi? Well, first, obviously, the lines speak to the central dilemma that he is faced with in Auschwitz, which is how to distinguish what is it that makes a human being human, and can it be disposed of? Can it be got rid of by other people? How can these prisoners, in the abyss that they're living in the squalor and in the selfishness that they are forced to live in, be thought of as human. Second, the lines speak of a context which, to anyone who knows the poem, as Primo Levi does, is already pessimistic. Ulysses' ship will go down. He tells these guys to, persuades these guys to go with him, but they will all drown, all of them. The ship will sink. I said drowning was an important idea in this work. And it's this mixture, I think, of heroism and ambition and aspiration with doom, with facing death and actual dying, that gives this passage its extraordinary mixed tone of exaltation and urgency and also of despair. That mixed tone that's so, it's all there on the last page of this chapter, page 121. I must explain to him, this is four lines down in my edition anyway, on page 121, last but one paragraph of the Canto of Ulysses. I must tell him, I must explain to him about the Middle Ages, but still more something gigantic that I myself have only just seen in a flash of intuition, perhaps the reason for our fate, for our being here today. We are now in the soup queue, among the sordid, ragged crowd of soup carriers from other commandos. Those just arrived press against our backs. Krautert Ruben, the official announcement is made that the soup today is of cabbages and turnips. He gives other languages. And then he quotes the end of the Canto of Ulysses in Dante at the end of his own chapter about that canto, and over our heads, the hollow seas closed up. Now, the importance of Dante to Levi was obviously partly national. This is the great classic of Italian literature, ranking in terms of Italian literary consciousness with Shakespeare, shall we say. It's the text everybody reads, some of at school, studies at university, and has enormous symbolic as well as intrinsic meaning. But of course, it's and part of that is, of course, that it's a world text and has had enormous influence on literatures of many different countries. I think it's also important in this context, though it's never stated, that the Divine Comedy is a Christian work. It's about the Christian cosmos. And Levi, after all, is in the camp because he's a Jew. He's not himself a believer of any kind. But his focusing on a Christian work seems to me to suggest the arbitrariness in itself, among other things, of his being there because he's a Jew. He's a Jew who can actually quote from and remember large parts of the Divine Comedy and to whom it's very important to impart it to another person in the camp. Now, how Dante's own poem works is to set the immense story it has to tell and the immense ideas it has to impart in a very rigid structural framework. There's an introductory stanza which makes the first, an introductory section, I'm sorry, book, which makes the first book of the Inferno. So the Inferno has 34 books, but actually one of them is an introduction to the whole thing. So it really counts as separate. So in essence, there are 33 cantos. There are also 33 cantos in the Purgatorio, and there are 33 in the Paradiso. So there's the first organizing principle, and I could go on about the symbolic point of these threes, because each canto is made up of three-line stanzas. And there's a very tight rhyming scheme, A, B, A, and then the B is picked up in the next stanza, B, C, B, and the C is picked up in the next stanza, C, D, C, and so on. So these threes are going through it. So there's this very severe structural framework. Now, Levi, too, was forced to deal with the problem of how to construct, how to organize his unmanageable material, unmanageable in scale, in misery, in the sheer number of people potentially involved, the extremity of their sufferings, the unmanageability of comprehending what all this is about, the unmanageability of producing an adequate emotional response to it. He used two main methods. I'm trying to draw attention to the fact that this is a supreme work of artifice as well as of factual storytelling. First of all, he used a scientific method. He was himself a chemist, as you know, and that's one of the reasons he survived. If this is a man, the scientific aspect is primarily a matter of tone, this calm, analytic, rarely emotional, or rarely superficially emotional, narration. What he calls his, with wonderful irony, and he's an ironic, and also, I think, quietly funny writer. He talks about his quiet study of the human mind. That's on page 15. He says, this book is going to be a quiet study of the human mind. Think about that in relation to what he's actually describing and what he's been through. A quiet study of the human mind. And if you look at the question and answer session at the end of most editions of this work, you'll find that there are various points that have been raised with Levy by his readers and by his critics, which he answers. And one of the key ones is to do with tone and this calm, quiet tone. People said, you should be angry about this. You should be writing in an angry way. And he tries to answer why it is that he's chosen the tone he has. Now, this scientific approach went further in a later book, a collection of essays and stories and part autobiographical meditations called The Periodic Table, Il Sistema Periodico, which I've given you a brief breakdown of on the back of the handout, not to think about particularly now. But the object of a periodic table in relation to chemical elements is like the object of a dictionary or an encyclopedia. It's to separate out specific elements of a complex whole so that they can be understood individually and grasped in their separateness. In chemistry, the periodic table classifies and systematizes and facilitates comparison between different types of chemical behavior. And one way of doing this, one organizing principle, is according to atomic number. That's to say, the number of protons in the atomic nucleus of each element. There's a connection between the periodic table and the spectrum in the visual sciences. We all know what a spectrum is in terms of what we can see, that it goes from red to violet. But if we know a bit more, we know that scientifically that's just a fraction of the whole thing, and that there are immense ranges of color at each end of the spectrum that we ourselves can't perceive. Similarly, I think Primo Levi suggests that there are forms of human behavior, categories of human experience, which are morally unintelligible, which are beyond us in some way. And even types and degrees of suffering, he suggests on page 79, in that section called A Good Day, act on a sort of spectrum themselves. For human nature is such, he says about just over halfway down the page on 79, that grief and pain, even simultaneously suffered, do not add up as a whole in our consciousness, but hide the lesser behind the greater according to a definite law of perspective. Now, I said one organizational approach in this work is scientific. The other is to focus, on individuals, on the individual experiences, individual places, individual days, individual situations, above all on individual people. This may sound as if it's the obvious thing to do, but of course it was a challenge to precisely what the regime he was living under tried to obliterate, and he himself movingly describes the ways in which people on arrival at the camp were, so far as possible, deprived of their individuality. Their clothes were taken, their hair was shaved, they were given a number, and everybody from that day on officially lost his or her name. And Levi, one of Levi's key, simple, powerful responses to this in If This Is a Man is repeatedly to insist on the names of the people he's talking about. The attempt of the camps to obliterate personality was reinforced by an attempt to prevent communication. I said that a periodic table is in some ways like a dictionary, but of course in Auschwitz there were no dictionaries, there were no encyclopedias, there were no books of any kind. But there were also too many languages and too few words. On the one hand, this is a place Levi compares with the Tower of Babel. Babel gets its name from the Hebrew word for jumble, balal. And in Jewish and Christian mythology, both, Babel is a place where God deals with the excessive pride of a fallen human race by dispersing human beings geographically and causing them to speak different languages so they can't communicate with each other. It's a way of stopping them from being too united. The Lager takes this process a stage further by forming a linguistic hell in which you are given orders in languages you can't understand and required to obey them instantly. At the same time, while it's a hell of excessive words, of too many languages being spoken all around you, it's also one of linguistic starvation. There are no words here for what the camp is actually about. Which is, as Levi says on page 32 of this translation, the demolition of a human. There isn't a word for that. So it's appropriate that the title of the book not only raises the question what humanity consists of, but does so in a grammatical form that is neither a question nor a hypothesis, that is a kind of nonsense. If this is a man, is it the second half of a question, of a statement? Is it the first half? What is it? Grammatically, it's itself a jumble, and yet one that is powerfully evocative. So, on the one hand, Levi responds to and answers the obliteration of identity by focusing on and restoring and preserving individual cases. So he responds to Babel and to non-communication by testifying to and exemplifying the survival of language in its most densely meaningful forms, in poetry and in stories, and literature and narrative are, and the use of words, are themes that run right through the book. There's the storyteller who makes a tour of the huts in Chapter 5. There are the life stories that the inmates tell each other. We tell them, I can't remember the page this quotation is on, I'm sorry I didn't write it down. We tell them to each other in the evening, and they take place in Norway, Italy, Algeria, the Ukraine, and are single and incomprehensible, like stories in the Bible. But are they not themselves stories of a new Bible? Are they not themselves stories of a new Bible? We were thinking, let's go back to the Canto of Ulysses. He has this flash of intuition on page 121. A flash of intuition, perhaps the reason for our fate, for our being here today. What is it? We are never told. It's as if the arrival of the soup obliterates it, or his memory has lost it. It is perhaps what's meant by the drowning with which this chapter ends and with which Dante's Canto ends. But perhaps there are answers elsewhere in this book, and I'm going to suggest there may be an answer too in the sequel to it, The Truth. And just as the Divine Comedy is a deeply symmetrical book, so the La Trega, which is a later book of Levy's, and is usually printed in the second half of editions. And I didn't ask you to read it because it's this book I wanted you to read, but you might be interested to read it because it's the journey backwards, and it's a very difficult journey, like Odysseus's journey. It's you'd think, okay, the war's over, the camps are liberated, now they go home. But actually, Europe was in such desolation, the transport systems were so chaotic, the rail lines and the roads were destroyed. There was no food, there was no means of dealing with these hundreds and thousands and millions of people, refugees, not only from the camps, but from the destroyed cities, that it takes him ages to get back. So there's this symmetry between the two halves, if you put them together. But I want, first of all, just to look at briefly at remind you about chapter 14, three chapters after the Canto of Ulysses. This chapter is called Crouse, and it's the name is the name of the central character. The subject, the theme and the mood are very, very different, but the dynamic is similar. Just like with the Canto of Ulysses, we begin in a hellish place. It's a hell of damp and mud. The focus, again, is on a single character whom we haven't met before and won't see again. And in this case, Krauss, unlike Jean, is somebody whom it's very clear, who it's very clear is one of the drowned. He misses his stroke, and this is page 138. A lump of mud flies up and splatters over my knees. It's not the first time it's happened. I warn him to be careful, without much hope. And so it goes on. He's exhausted and hopeless. Once again here, Levy, as in the Canto of Ulysses, is going to dwell on the workings of the mind and of imagination, and particularly the capacity of the mind to invent, and the problem of communication. Just as he told a story to Jean in chapter 11, the story of Ulysses in Dante, now he tells one to Krauss, but this is one he's made up. The Italian Primo Levi, talking to the Hungarian Krauss in bad German, tells him he has had a dream in which he has seen Krauss clean at home, clean and well-fed, and welcome in Primo Levi's own house. Now, in the last words of that chapter, Levi dispels this dream as forcefully as Prospero dispels the fantasy at the end of The Tempest. Poor silly Krauss, he says, if he only knew that it is not true, that I have really dreamt nothing about him, that he is nothing to me except for a brief moment. Nothing like everything is nothing down here except the hunger inside and the cold and the rain around. It's a savage moment. But the difference from between that and Prospero's eloquence at the end of The Tempest is that the Prospero's eloquence isn't only addressed to the audience, it's addressed to the other characters in the play. Whereas Krauss doesn't hear this. He's left with his illusion. Primo Levi is talking to his readers, but not to Krauss. So that the question is, the situation is, that he has been left with the illusion that Levy has generously given him. Stories, in other words, whether written by Dante or stories told in Auschwitz, can make people feel slightly less bad, can improve their situation, if only for the time being. And perhaps it's this ability to invent and to narrate, to remember, to suspend disbelief, that defines us, not only in the modern world, but in the ancient world, as human beings. Perhaps it is the answer to Levy's implied question in the title. Perhaps it's this storytelling that gives us our meaning. Now, I'm going to end reasonably early today, but I just want to point you to a little passage in The Truce. It's on page 197, if you've got the same pagination. Has everybody got the same pagination as me, more or less? Page 197. This is after the camp, after the war has been won by the Allies. The camp has, in a sense, been liberated, but The first problem of the liberated camps was that people were still dying. It didn't suddenly turn out okay. There wasn't suddenly a lot of food, and if there was food, people couldn't digest it. Some people died of the food they were brought because it was too much for them. There were still terrible illnesses, and the whole structure had broken down. So the early stages of the truce are about really the tragedies and the continuations of the camp after everything ought to be all right. And here we are introduced to a new character yet again called Hubinek. And I just want to read this page and a half to you and ask you to think about what I've been saying about what Levy seems to me to be focusing on and how he organizes it and what the underlying ideas of this extraordinary book are. Hubinek, page 197, was a nobody, a child of death, a child of Auschwitz. He looked about 3 years old. No one knew anything of him. He could not speak, and he had no name. That curious name, Hubinek, had been given to him by us, perhaps by one of the women who had interpreted with those syllables one of the inarticulate sounds that the baby let out now and again. He was paralyzed from the waist down with atrophied legs as thin as sticks, but his eyes, lost in his triangular and wasted face, flashed terribly alive, full of demand, assertion of the will to break loose, to shatter the tomb of his dumbness. I want you to think about this language aspect that I've been talking about, but also something I haven't mentioned, which is the intensity with which Levy visualizes and makes us visualize this person. And you'll see that what he has to say about that process of bringing him to life in a moment. The speech he lacked, which no one had bothered to teach him, the need of speech charged his stare with explosive urgency. It was a stare both savage and human, even mature, a judgment which none of us could support, so heavy was it with force and anguish. None of us, that is, except Hennek. He was in the bunk next to me, a robust and hearty Hungarian boy of 15. Hennek spent half his day beside Hubinek's pallet, a bed. He was maternal rather than paternal. Had our precarious coexistence lasted more than a month, it's extremely probable that Hubinek would have learnt to speak from Hennek, certainly better than from the Polish girls who, too tender and too vain, inebriated him with caresses and kisses, but shunned intimacy with him. Hennek, on the other hand, calm and stubborn, sat beside the little sphinx, immune to the distressing power he emanated. He brought him food to eat, adjusted his blankets, cleaned him with skillful hands, without repugnance, and he spoke to him in Hungarian, naturally, in a slow and patient voice. After a week, Hennek announced seriously, but without a shadow of self-consciousness, that Hubinek could say a word. What word? He didn't know, a difficult word, not Hungarian, something like masklo, matisklo. During the night, we listened carefully. It was true. From Hubinek's corner, there occasionally came a sound, a word. It was not admittedly always exactly the same word, but it was certainly an articulated word, or better, several slightly different articulated words, experimental variations on a theme, on a route, perhaps on a name. Hubinek continued in his stubborn experiments for as long as he lived. In the following days, everybody listened to him in silence, anxious to understand, and among us there were speakers of all the languages of Europe. But Hubinek's word remained secret. No, it was certainly not a message. It was not a revelation. Perhaps it was his name, if it had ever fallen to his lot to be given a name. Perhaps, according to one of our hypotheses, it meant to eat, or bread, or perhaps meat in Bohemian, as one of us who knew that language maintained. Hubinek, who was 3 years old, and perhaps had been born in Auschwitz and had never seen a tree, Hubinek, who had fought like a man to the last breath to gain his entry into the world of men, from which a bestial power had excluded him, Hubinek the nameless, whose tiny forearm, even his, bore the tattoo of Auschwitz. Hubinek died in the first days of March 1945, free, but not redeemed. Nothing remains of him. He bears witness through these words of mine. Thank you.